And how are Orkanders dealing with it? Are they getting behind the
pop? Well, according to polls, everybody wants them to stand down. But according to public turnout and how much of a stink they're actually kicking up about it, doesn't appear that they really want to actually do it justice kind of thing. You know how people just sometimes lose their motivation? They go, well.
Well, that's right. That's right. You can actually, I've been to meetings where you have a meeting about changing something and there's 50 people in the room and they all put their hands up and they all say, I want to do something about it. And then they all vote for somebody to go and be the spokesperson. And when that person turns around, there's not a single person behind them. And that's the nature of people. If you want to start a revolution, you've got to make sure that you've got the crowd behind you. Otherwise, you're going to find yourself at the front of nothing.
So this is part of the reason why I think democracy doesn't work very well. I mean, in Latin it means mob rule, and as far as I know, that hasn't worked out too well at many protests.
No, it's you've got to push people pretty hard before they actually start getting up and protesting, but it doesn't really happen in New Zealand anymore. You'll get a handful of people, but I think the days of the protesting, the apartheid and South African tour and the nuclear and bombs and Mururoa and all that, I think those days of real protesting have gone, because there isn't the backing through the media. We were all too controlled through the media, and the media think that Len Brown's okay, so that means everybody thinks that the media's okay, so then Len Brown must be okay, so they just back off.
They just go, oh, okay.
Yeah, that's right.
That's freaking ridiculous. Yeah.
You need some people in the community to actually start telling the truth and talking, but unfortunately, they've all gone to Australia. And, of course, they're all being replaced by these slaves from overseas.
Yeah. I prefer the slaves that were born right here, you know.
Well, in the old days, if you were born in a land or a patch of dirt, that was your home, and you fought for it. This is why when you get countries like America and England and France and Germany and Italy, when they invade somebody else's country, they can never really understand why these people fight so well. And it's because these people have got nowhere else to go. They're fighting for their land. So they will fight to the death because they simply have got nowhere else to go. But if you're asking the English soldier or the American soldier, are you prepared to die in these countries? And they'll say, well, I don't know. Why are we fighting? It's a very different ball game when you're out in a battle and fighting. If you're an American soldier fighting in France and Germany in the Second World War, then you have a reason to fight. You're fighting for democracy. You're fighting to free countries that have been overrun by Nazism and Hitler and all the rest of it. But if you invade Iraq and Afghanistan and all your mates have been shot all around you, and you're asked, why are you fighting? A lot of these Americans will just simply say, we don't know. We're just here because we're slaves to the system. But the Afghanis and the Iraqis, they know exactly why they're fighting. And that's why, after 10, 12 years, they're still fighting. Because they've got nowhere else to go. And they will continue fighting until the Americans are gone. That's how it works.
How many people have tried to conquer Afghanistan?
Yeah, I know. It's a bit like Napoleon trying to go and cross, and knock over Russia. There are some things that are just not going to happen.
Yeah, it's like, I know it's impossible, I know it's insane, but I'm going to throw somebody else's kids at it anyway.
That's right. And as I say, the Afghanis, they know their land, and they know their people, and they know how to fight. And even though they're fighting a war machine like America and England, and with all their technology, it is still a fight that the Americans and the British are not winning. Their soldiers are still dying over there, and they're not conquering any land. They're not getting anything out of it, of course, except the opium and the oil and the gas.
But I suppose that's enough.
That's enough, yes, that's enough. It's money. It's all you need. It's just plenty of money. And that's where. And it doesn't matter if you knock over 100,000 people wearing headbands and cotton clothes, and killing these people with F-16 bombers and laser-guided bombs is really easy, especially when you can do it from sitting in your home in California, and that's what it's all about. So it becomes very easy, and you can just knock over these people in their tens of thousands. And who cares? You know, the Western world doesn't really care, because they get their oil and they get their gas and they get their lights and they get their television and they get their newspaper. But there's an awful lot of people who are dying all over the world to provide it.
It reminds me of the scene in Braveheart when he goes, would you like to use the archers, sire? And he goes, not the archers. Arrows cost money. Use up the Irish. The dead cost nothing.
That's dead right. That's the attitude. That's how it works. The Romans did that quite well, because whenever they went into a new country, they never put their own soldiers into it. Once they'd knocked over the resistance, as it were, they put in soldiers from all over the empire. And it destabilized the army, where they couldn't get together and say, well, look, I want to go home. You know, they just stayed where they were put. So it was quite amazing. If you go to England and go up to Hadrian's Wall, you find Roman soldiers there from all over the empire. They weren't Romans. They were people from all over the empire. Yeah.
And I think that's part of the reason why the Roman Empire was so successful, is because it's a hell of a lot easier to oppress people if they're not your people.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, they don't care who they're killing or who they're oppressing. But but the Roman Empire was successful because they were a very disciplined group. But in the end, corruption got the better of it. The Romans didn't lose any battles. You know, they didn't collapse because they were up against an enemy that destroyed them. They were up against their own corruption at home in Rome. Rome collapsed, and then the whole of the Roman Empire collapsed. And that's the way the British Empire has gone, and that's the way the American Empire will go and is going. It's just collapsing because of the total corruption at the top.
It's just what happens to empires, all right? Empires get built by a whole bunch of scumbags fiefing off with other people's stuff. Empires fall because they run out of stuff to steal. You know, it's kind of like... there's a famous quote, the trouble with socialism is that eventually you run out of everybody else's money.
That's right. That's exactly it. And the Romans, as you quite rightly pointed out, I mean, the Romans actually conquered the known world. So once they had conquered the known world, there was no other country to rape and pillage. So there was, after that happened, there was a limited amount of money within the system. So all the money started to gravitate toward one area, and of course that became the centre of the money, and so the rest of the empire just collapsed, because the money was going to one point. If you keep on conquering countries, you can keep on redistributing the wealth, and even the soldiers get a good hand of it, you know, they get their bonus. But if you stop conquering countries because there's nothing left to conquer, then there's no money, so everything falls apart, because all of it ends up back in Rome. And this was the way the British Empire went. Once they started losing all their colonies, the money dried up. And America is exactly the same thing's happening in America. They're being squeezed out from all of the world, all over the place, because countries are absolutely sick of what the Americans have done. And so they're squeezing them out in a big way. And America will implode. It's only a question of time now before America completely implodes.
Everybody's been talking about the upcoming American implosion, and they've been talking about it for so long. It's almost like they're trying to wear you down and get you to accept the American collapse. But I don't know, but I think there's still a lot of creativity and a lot of strength left in the American people, well, some of them anyway.
Don't get me wrong there, but there is a huge difference between Washington and the American people. The American people have got fantastic resilience, and they're hugely creative people and very industrious. I mean, you ask the Americans to do something and they'll get on and do it. Whereas when you go to places like Italy, you've got to have a debate. But it's the economy, it's the American way, it's the American sense of freedom. There's an awful lot of states in America, we found when we were over there, who are actually talking about seceding from the Union. And they've had enough of Washington, and they want to pull out. And we were speaking to a girl in a cafe bar in Montana, I think it was, just before we hopped over the border into Canada. And she recognized our accents, and she said, oh, where are you from? So we said, New Zealand. And she said, oh, usual thing, you know. She said, I've always wanted to go there. So my wife said, why? And she immediately said, oh, well, you know, it's such a beautiful country. She said she'd been to Australia, but she didn't have time to go to New Zealand and all that. And then her next question was, what do you think of America? So my wife, after 8 weeks of traveling through America, she said, your country's screwed. And the girl actually looked quite shocked. But then, amazingly, she bent over double, she slapped her thigh, she burst out laughing, and she said, you're absolutely right. And then she started telling us how she thought America was in the education system. And she said to me, what do you think we should do about it? And on the spur of the moment, I hadn't thought about it at all, but on the spur of the moment, I said, you need to break away. The various states need to break away from Washington and start recreating your own identity and start looking after your own money. And she, again, she looked quite shocked, and she looked around the room to see who was listening, and there was nobody else in place. But she was worried, you see. She had to look around to see who was listening. And then she said, you know, there are a number of people who are talking that way now. And that was quite amazing, because, I mean, as I say, I just thought of it on the spur of the moment, but it was quite clear that there are a lot of people in America who are thinking that their states could do very well, thank you, without the backing of Washington, and hang on to their money and their identity. So it's an interesting, America's going to be going through some interesting times, but certainly the America of 1945 has completely disappeared. And the America of 1969 that put a man on the moon, that has also disappeared. So what we have left now is just a monster that's just going around with drones all over the world, just creating wars and unrest, and thriving on it and making money out of it. But it's up to the world to turn around and say, to stop them. And I think they have, because they did in Syria. Good old John Kerry and Barack Obama were absolutely determined they were going to go into Syria and just bomb everybody, just like they did in Libya.
Those guys are just freaking vermin.
Yeah. Who? What, in Syria?
No, John Kerry.
Yeah, I know.
And Pacho Barry.
Well, you see, they were determined. I mean, they were telling me, it was all over the news, every channel was saying it, John Kerry was saying it, you know, we're going to go in there, we're going to sort it out, we've got all our fleets and aircraft carriers and cruise missiles and all the rest of it. And they didn't. And I think the world hasn't woken up to it yet, but history was made a few months ago, because there were some countries in this planet of ours who actually stood up to America and said, no, you're not going to do it. You're going to leave Syria alone. And the only concession they got out of it was the assumed chemical weapons that were there that had to be deactivated and sent offshore. And that, and after that, who gives a shit about Syria anymore? You know, and nobody really talks about Syria. You know, so one minute we're hearing all over the news about the desperate situation in Syria and the millions dying and the disease and all the rest of it, and then all of a sudden nobody gives a shit about Syria anymore, and we're all focusing on the Ukraine. So, you know, you have to wonder where
which is incidentally another proxy war that the United States is trying to start.
That's exactly right. They'll just keep on going around the planet just to stir things up all over.
When the hell was there actually... Like, seriously, I've had a look at, like, the financing of who financed Hitler in World War II and all of this other kind of stuff, right? And it turns out that the Americans and whoever else is fighting... never the ones financing themselves. They're always borrowing off the same big group of frickin' bankster scum anyway. So it doesn't matter why the war is fought. The point is that everybody gets in debt as a result of it. I mean, like, how much money would you borrow if the alternative to borrowing more than the other guy was for him to defeat you and kill you and enslave your people? You'd borrow as much as you wanted, right? As much as you could. So that you could kill and enslave the other guy's people before he does the same thing to you. The irony is even if you win your war against the bad guy who's screwing you over and destroying your country, you still get enslaved by the bankers.
That's right. That's right. Nobody wins at the end of the day. It's just the banks and the people at the top that control it all.
What was that old saying? A war doesn't determine who wins or loses. It only determines who is left.
Yes, and who's controlling. Who's in control at the end of the day? I wrote another book just recently on the politics of 9/11 in America and all the rest of it, and in it I've got a chapter there that talks about the American Civil War. And one of the things that, if you ever study the American Civil War, that one of the things that crops up time and time again is that the American soldiers north and south often could not understand why they were fighting. You know, even in the middle of a fight, I think it was at Gettysburg, we went there and visited. It's a very, it's an interesting place to go to and visit Gettysburg. There's so much to learn there. But one of the incredible things that we read about was on, I think, the last day of the battle, some Confederate soldiers were trying desperately to take control of a hill. And a Union man shot a Confederate guy. Didn't kill him, but shot him, and then went down the hill to look for him and care for him. And one of the first things he said was, "What the hell are you guys doing here? Why are you fighting?" And this was a question that cropped up time and time again in the American Civil War between the Union soldiers and the Confederate soldiers. They didn't know why they were fighting each other, brother and brother and father against son. And it was just a corporate war. It was the beginning of American corporate war. The North wanted power and control and money, and they had Washington and the federal government. The South actually just wanted their identity and their market, which was the Southern market was actually expanding at a phenomenal rate, and that was severely worrying the North. And this is what I wrote in the book, in that it's all about who's going to dominate at the end, who's going to be the power broker, and who controls the money, the purse strings. Well, at the end of the war, there was no question that the South was physically and financially ruined. And this is supposed to be the Union, you know, the America, the land of the free. Well, it wasn't. It was the North versus the South, and the North wanted the money and the clout and the power, and they got it. They won the battle.
It was the land of the free. Now it's the home of the slaves.
That's right. The whole idea of having a president and Congress and freedom and all the rest of it is an absolute eyewash, because at the end of the day, they might as well call their president Your Majesty, because they've ended up with exactly the same system. You know, they went over there and they had their states and they had their fields, and they took it all off the local Indians, of course. But once they had established themselves over there, they fought for them, for their independence from England. And that was fair enough. England was taxing them and wanted more money out of them, and they turned around and said, "No, you can't do this, we won't have it." And they fought the English to have independence, and that was okay, that worked well. But then it all fell to pieces, because then they joined up all the states in this confederacy. And as soon as they did that, of course, you have to have a boss. You have to have a president. You have to have a king. You have to have a leader. And once you've got that, you've got a god. And once you've got a god, they want everything. So the whole thing fell down. In a matter of just a few generations, what all these people that left Europe for this freedom of individuals, of their freedom of rights, freedom of expression, it was all taken away from them as soon as they created the United States. Because it just meant that there was a boss. You had a king. Before that, they were all free. Each state was independent. Every man was independent. Every man was free. And then they all joined together and called themselves a union. It's a bit like having a coalition, isn't it?
Coalition of the willing, or coalition of the killing, or
it was the slang word for the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, the Bush administration was always saying, "Oh, look, our allies, our coalition partners." You know, it made it sound very.
We need a coalition for peace, like a coalition of the chilling.
A coalition of the what?
Of the chilling, you know. Just like send them into countries and just like I don't know, just go chill out, bro. You know, stop trying to kill each other out.
Well, that's the difference between having a court of justice and a court of law. you have a court of justice when you want truth, and you have a court of law when you want to bust everything.
Yeah. Well, I said for a long time that the legal system is supposed to do what's lawful, but the only thing they're capable of doing is what's awful.
Yeah, but you're following a doctrine. It's like having all these drink drivers. And they have a drink driver and they let him off, and then they catch this drink driver again and they let him off, then they catch him again and they let him off. The law is an ass, but then what you've got is these other lawyers that come around and say, "Oh, well, if you take away this guy's license, he can't work, so you know, you can't drive anywhere, so he can't work." So you have a dispensation on the law, so So you have a law, but it doesn't actually exist. It doesn't work in practice. And then all of a sudden you'll get things on Campbell Live where they say, oh, well, this guy's got 10 crimes, you know, where he's been caught driving, loaded up with alcohol, and they still give him back his license. And then people turn around and say, well, how can you have it 10 times or 100 times? Now, how do these people rack up $500,000 worth of parking fines and unpaid fines? Well, you know, you've basically got a system that is just simply not working. Because if you're going to have a fine, then make it work. And if you're going to have to make it criminal to drink and drive, then take away the license, take away the car, and put the person in jail. Now, of course, if these people have a severe medical problem or a psychiatric problem or an emotional problem, well, then you deal with it, but you deal with it in a different way. But the system of law in this country is that you just keep on giving the people back their license, you keep on giving them back the hammer they used to kill their children with, and I can't believe this country and the number of children that get killed here. It's just...
Oh, especially the amount that get die in state care.
Yeah, it defies belief. When I came to New Zealand, I couldn't believe the apathy that people have towards a child being murdered. I can't comprehend it. I just cannot comprehend it. But it's been like that for the 30 years I've been in this country. If a child dies, it's business as usual the next day. Who cares? There's no protest in the streets. There's no nothing. The politicians have been jumping up for 30 years, and we are still no nearer getting a resolution to the problem or dealing with the problem whatsoever. And there'll be another child killed in the next few weeks. It'll go on and on and on. But, you know, when you live in a system that simply doesn't care, then you can't deal with it.
They simply don't care because I think it's what we were talking about earlier, is that they've lost their humanity. And I don't... It just seems like predatory, more or less. I think that's really the only word I can use to describe this this culture. Is just, it's ruled by predators. I mean, it's no different to how a man... let's say, make a whole bunch of cows, live in a paddock for a while, take care of them before killing them and eating them.
Yeah.
It's no different. We're being farmed.
We are being farmed, I think. Everything about us, telecom, Vodafone, Genesis Energy, Contact Energy, Fonterra, forestry, gold, oil, everything. There isn't an aspect of our life today that isn't a profit-making agenda, following the profit-making agenda. And humanity is part of it. We are being bred, or people are being bred, to be dehumanized. You only have to watch the television programs, the computer games that children are playing. It is actually quite astonishing to talk to some people and talk to them about young people and talk to them about life and death. And they look bemused. There is a look of complete bewilderment in their eyes to try and understand the difference between life and death. And you often see it in the media. When the Christchurch earthquake happened and they began to realize that people had died down there, you had idiot reporters going down and sticking microphones in people's faces who are obviously distressed and saying to them, well, how do you feel about this? You know, if somebody ever did that to me, I would just simply plant them there and then. You know, it's such a stupid question. There is no...
Hello, do you think, scumbag?
There's no...
Crack him in the face, and then grab the microphone off him. Now, how do you feel? Hey! Hey!
I would ram it up their backsides and ask them, how do you feel about it? And then
is
when
this
they
an audible proctology exam?
And of course, what they do in this country, and this is what the Law Society does, is that the first thing they do is put fear into you by threatening you with taking you to court and suing you and taking away your house, your car, your family and everything else. This is the standard normal practice for lawyers to protect themselves, is that they will threaten you with court action. Now, of course, if you, like I did, and this is an interesting thing, when I started to really dive into this case that I was mentioning earlier, I actually spoke to one solicitor in New Plymouth. And, of course, the word was starting to bounce around the corridors of power that Ian Paquin was making waves. And so this solicitor, after dealing with some issues with the case, then turned to me and he said, "Oh, you know, Ian, you've got to be really careful, you know, about saying bad things about solicitors, or one solicitor in particular." And I said, "Oh, why is that?" And he said, "Well, you know, she can sue you for defamation of character and blah, blah, blah." And I just looked at him and I said, "Yep." Yeah. And I said, "And then what?" And you know, this guy just looked at me and looked at me and looked at me, and 20 seconds went past. And he said, "Oh, is that what you're doing?" And what I was basically, what I had in my mind was the fact that, yes, you can threaten me with suing me. The trouble is, the truth is on my side. And if this solicitor wanted to sue me, all well and good, because I'll meet her in court, and then I will say what I have to say. And the last thing that they want to do is to have all of their shit dragged through a public court. So there is not the slightest chance in the world that they'll ever sue you. As long as you are right and you've got the facts on your side, there's no way that these people will ever sue you. And this is what happened when I wrote this book. I named all these solicitors and lawyers who have been involved in this case. I named them in the book, they're on the front page. And I haven't had a single phone call from any of them. And then I wrote another book, which I printed out last year, and I named them all again, and I still haven't had any phone calls.
I always wondered why solicitors never got booked for solicitation.
That's a good point.
I mean, ain't that illegal?
I actually asked this solicitor, I said, "What's the difference between a solicitor and a lawyer?" And you know, he couldn't answer. I was absolutely gobsmacked. I thought, I'm asking a legitimate question here, because this was back in the days when I had nothing to do with the law. You know, the law was there in the background. You know, if you go through a red light, you get stopped, you get taken to court, you find $100. And that to me was the law. That's all the interest in the law I had. But when I got involved with this case, it really opened my eyes, and I started reading books and learning all about these people. And one of the things I couldn't find in the books was what the difference was between a solicitor and a lawyer. So I asked this solicitor, and he couldn't answer. And I thought, well, no, that's absolutely typical. That's why these people, you cannot communicate with these people, because they're actually as thick as shit. They are really some of the most ignorant people you'll ever meet in your life. I can say that straight from the heart. I mean, I'm 58 years old. I've traveled around the world. I've been a marine engineer and done a lot of things in my life. And I have never, ever in my life met anybody like these people. They're stupid beyond belief. You cannot communicate with these people in any shape or form. So the only way I could... This is why I wrote the book. Because if you can't talk to them, you can't solve any problems. You can't deal with the issues. And even though they've set up systems and they had a complaints authority to complain to, I mean, that was a waste of time as well. And then when that fails in those days, you could go to the... there was a word for them. I can't remember what it was. No, it wasn't the ombudsman. It was...
Solicitor General?
No, the government had produced four people that were designated areas throughout New Zealand, and they were given, if you weren't satisfied with the Law Society's dealings with the complaint, you could go to these people, and they were like an ombudsman, but they were an officially designated one by the government. But they had no powers whatsoever. The whole thing was a scam, a complete game. But anyway, I wrote to this person and got absolutely nothing back, and that was a waste of time. So I wrote to the Justice Minister, and that was a waste of time. So I wrote to the Prime Minister, and that was a waste of time. Then the Solicitor General and the Governor General. So there was nobody left in New Zealand for me to write to. And at that point, then I realised, well, if you can't talk to these people and they're not going to talk to you, the only thing left for me to do was to write a book. So I wrote this book, and I told them all I was going to do it. It wasn't as though it was a shock to them. I think they were just surprised that I actually went ahead and did it. They all thought that there's just no way that I could write anything that could disturb them, you know, because they are lawyers. They control the system. So anyway, I wrote this book and printed out 700 copies and sent them all around the country. And the silence was shattering, absolutely shattering. But it tells you a lot, you know. It's like looking for a black hole. You can't see a black hole. So what you do is you look for everything around it that's just disappearing. And it's the same with lawyers. The fact that you can write a book and name all these people and call them all sorts of things that I did and get no response whatsoever tells you more truth than if you went there and actually spoke to them. But you see, it's a no-win situation.
Well, of course, you wouldn't get any truth if you went there and spoke to them yourself anyway.
No,
you?
Well, this is right. And this is what happened, you see. This is why I wrote the book, because you physically cannot communicate with these people. They don't.
I was saying for a while now, Ian, that New Zealand is so corrupt that the people who are in charge of exposing corruption don't report any of it because they're too corrupt.
That's right. They're all in on it. This is what I proved. See, I followed the, back in 2006, 2007, I was still a naive guy that actually thought that there were organizations and tribunals and committees that dealt with these problems. And there isn't. This is what I found, that I had to prove it to myself first before I could do anything. So, I confronted the solicitor at the time and got nowhere. So then I confronted the senior partner of the firm and got absolutely nowhere. And so then I went to the Taranaki District Law Society and got nowhere. So then I went to the New Zealand Law Society. Yes, I went to them and they admitted that they had absolutely no responsibility. It was incredible. The individual, the local law district law societies, they had total authority over any complaints. The New Zealand Law Society had no authority to do anything about it. So then, of course, I thought, well, the New Zealand Law Society only exists because of the government grant, so I went to the Justice Minister, and he wrote a letter to me and told me he wasn't responsible for anything. So then I thought, well, I'll write to the Prime Minister, and the Prime Minister sent me a letter saying thank you for your letter. And then I wrote to the Governor General and the Solicitor General and got two more letters saying thank you for your letter. So then I wrote another letter to the... that body to do with corporate fraud and this...
the Prime Minister's office?
Yeah, well, that was a waste
of time. Oh, I don't know. That was the one that that perpetrates the corporate fraud. Oh, yeah. Well, they incidentally are involved in a lot of the world.
Yeah.
The country's serious frauds at the moment.
So I just kept on getting letters saying, with various letterheads, all politely saying, thank you very much for your letter, blah, 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 and absolutely nothing happened. So what I did was I actually proved that from the solicitor all the way up to the very top of the mountain, the midden, there was no responsibility. Nobody gave a shit. So I thought, when I got to that point, I knew then that I can write a book, because if nobody's going to listen to you, then you're entitled to write a book and say all these things. So that's exactly what I did.
Hmm.
And it upset them. It upset them quite a lot. But they won't talk to me.
Do you like the whole them being upset thing, or are you kind of like, you know, one day they're going to pull a Winston Peters on me from all his enemies from the old wine box inquiry? And
No, I've got no concerns over that whatsoever. And I mean, it was satisfying in the fact that I wrote a book and I could just take away their manner. They don't have a lot of prestige these days, especially in Taranaki. They're idiots to the nth degree. But that was a one-off. I mean, I did that. I mean, I could follow it up with another book or two to do with the entire process. It's not difficult when you're dealing with such supreme idiots. It's not difficult.
Oh, they're like a gold mine. You know, they're like the Three Stooges or something like that. It doesn't matter what the hell they're doing. It's freaking hilarious.
Yeah. It is hilarious. You've only got to look at some of the things that go on television, you know, when you get all these lawyers and stuff. Look at that, what was her name? Davina Murray, who gave an iPhone to that criminal in jail. I mean, she broke and busted and bent every rule in the book. There were no ethics to be had there at all, and yet she felt free and easy and completely unfazed by doing what she was doing. And Eventually, the law society decided they might do something about it. But this is the attitude that they have. The attitude has completely changed from 100 years ago. You know, people had ethics, they had morals. They had a sense of what was right and wrong within the individual. But now you have 11,000 lawyers, solicitors, and barristers in this country whose sole purpose it is to find ways of destroying the law so then they can make money. That is how they are morally and ethically guided these days. And the government condones it. The government absolutely encourages it.
That's true. I think, was it earlier this year or maybe last year, a couple of years, but I forget when, but the national government's in power and they were approached to look into judicial corruption in this country, considering most of the judges are related by, like, first cousin or something like that.
Oh, that's absolutely right.
Yeah. And the government says, well, if there is corruption, we don't want to be seen to be doing anything about it because that might be bad for our public profile.
Yeah, they can play games with it as much as they want, because one of the major, major arguments that the Law Society has for having being a separate entity from government is that if they are being controlled by government, then of course the idea then is that government will interfere with judicial proceedings. So the argument, of course, and it's a logical and legitimate argument, that that's how it should be, because otherwise you have to have an independent authority with the law to uphold the law. Now, the government is still the ultimate maker of laws. Theoretically, the politicians are supposed to get down in government there, in parliament, and talk about it and thrash out a new law, you know, about ownership of land or flying planes or drugs or whatever. And then after that, the courts uphold the law. And the government no longer then interferes with any of the judicial systems. But the reality is that, of course, that the politicians and the lawyers and the judges are all hobnobbing together, and they're all discussing the cases, and they all know what's going on. And but there's enormous profits to be made, absolutely billions of dollars. So obviously, some of these cases that you hear, these murder cases, and what, they get dragged out for donkey's years because it makes money. It keeps the system affluent and effluent. It's what makes it's the oil in the cogs of the system.
I thought effluent was poo.
It is. That's what they are.
I'm effluent in three languages.
We live in an effluent society.
And especially in the Waikato.
Oh, I don't know much about the Waikato. I've never lived there. I've driven through it many times.
It's cow country. They named their rugby team after the Mulu men, as in the cow men. So it must be full of cow crap.
It must be. There's a lot of cow crap there. But
even worse than cow crapper crapper.
Yeah, I used to struggle over these New Zealand names. Used to call Wonga Momona Wonga Momona.
Wonga Momona.
Well.
It sounds like a cocktail, you know.
I know.
Like a mimosa.
And Pio Pio, you know, when somebody said it's not Pio Pio, it's Pew Pew. And I thought, well, how do you get Pew Pew out of P-I-O P-I-O? You know, you just have to learn how to say these things when you come over to New Zealand. But I've got it pretty good. I've sorted down. I mean, I can say Pohutukawa now. I struggled over Pohutukawa for quite a long time.
Yeah.
But we have a town around the coast here called Awokra. It's Okura. There are five different ways of saying it. It's Oakura, Okura. Oakura. Okra, yeah. Nobody actually knows how to say it.
Or eventually you give up and just go, oh my God.
Yeah, yeah. All the locals know what you're talking about because they all know that nobody knows. So they know
they all know that nobody knows.
Yeah.
The only thing that everybody knows is that nobody knows.
It's like going up to Otahuhu and Waikanae and you know, all these different places. You get to know it after a while.
Well, I think New Zealand culture's got this this really unique twerk and what have you. Did I say twerk?
You did.
I meant quirk. Do you know the difference between twerks and quirks?
You'll have to explain it to me. It sounds like the difference between quarks and atomic theory.
No, but all they do drink Ferengi beer. But the other element is twerking and what was the other thing that I said before? Twerking and something, I forget. Anyway, twerking is when a chick puts her bum in the air and kind of like shakes it around and what have you. It's big in the rap videos.
Oh, that's a new one on me. I've never heard of that.
Yeah. Well, you don't sound like the kind of man who watches too many hip-hop videos.
No, I don't. I'm a great lover of music and the arts, but there are one or two of the modern
ones. But hip hop and rap are not one of them.
Oh God, rap! I think is it's probably best if I don't give my opinion on rap in this program.
I've done a John Key rap.
Did you?
Yeah.
How did it go?
Incidentally, I have the thing here. We got the GCSB and the TICS. His name's John Key. For a liar, he's the best. Crack it open our nice national parks for mining corporate cronies, and his mates seem to take a shining. He's got shares in uranium and Jackson Mining. It's amazing how TV news can be so blinding. Want to restrict our snapper but not commercial operation. That's privatising the oceans, if I understand the equation. He got fracking consents to pollute the water table. Hydraulic chemicals and pressure make the land unstable. Deep sea oil bids going cheap for oil barons. Gulf of Mexico, BP, now the land is barren. And the Exxon Valdez got John Key, please. Wipe that bankster smile off your face before it's too late. His name's John Key, the Prime Sinister. Doesn't even measure up to be a minister with the lies and deception. In your own words, you lose the election when the people get hurt.
That was quite good.
Yeah. It goes on, but... Yeah.
Who wrote that?
That's me.
Oh, that was good. I'm impressed.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I just hate John Key so much... that I just can't get it out of the... Like, I do pictures, I do songs, I just rant about him on radio. Nothing seems to get the rage out of my blood vessels. It just doesn't work.
Hasn't he got a lovely smile, though?
I don't know. I don't know.
Don't you feel that when he's smiling, he's just looking down his nose at you and he says, well, I know what I'm doing and I know that you're getting screwed.
I don't know. It just feels like some kind of a movie where a demon suddenly possesses one of your loved ones, and that demon then smiles at you through your loved one's eyes, and it really, really freaks you out because you see that the thing that you love isn't there anymore, and and there's nothing but darkness and sadness and sorrowful woe.
Yep,
you know,
that's
right.
That's what my wife has said. She said, you know, he smiles, but the smile never reaches his eyes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I said that, actually. I was outdoors. It doesn't happen often, but it does. And what happened was we went out to go and ambush John Key when he was giving a speech at a school. But we thought maybe not at the school, maybe after when he comes out the gates or something like that. But the intel wasn't good, so there was no Prime Minister to be seen. It was unfortunate, but we just had to deal with it, as you do.
Mm.
And so I started just megaphoning in the general street area. And within 9 minutes, the police showed up. Pretty quick, especially for somebody who's not committing a crime. Although one could argue that free speech is a crime, but especially with the GCSB.
Yeah.
And... what was interesting is that we had a conversation with a cop, and the cop's conversation with us actually lasted longer than the protest did and scored more hits for the protest video.
That's good.
And he said to me, do you think that Friday afternoon is the, you know, Pommy cop, you know, we get a lot of imports over here, just almost as many as Japanese cars. And he says, is a 5 o'clock in the morning, in the afternoon, sorry, in Pukekohe, the appropriate place for this? And I go, yeah. And he goes, why is that? And he says, because we're already here. You know, why wouldn't you protest? And I think it's just, I don't expect anything to happen to come out of it, except to have fun on the day that I know that I actually did something and had some fun exposing some scumbaggery.
Yeah, no, I can appreciate that. When I published my book on the corruption of the New Zealand legal system, I was giving it away all free to everybody. And one of the things I did was I had about 200 of these things all in cardboard boxes, and I went and sat outside the New Plymouth Public Library all Saturday. And it was a beautiful, hot, sunny day. And I thought, you know, I'm bound to catch people who read books who go in and out of the library, and it seems to be a logical place to give them away. So I sat there on my own for the whole day from about 8:30, 9 o'clock through to 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I was pretty sunburned at the end of it. But I gave away 74 copies, I think. And all day I was thinking that there's bound to be a solicitor, there's bound to be somebody that comes up and talks to me about this. And I had a whacking great big sign next to me saying Law Society, Corruption, Stupidity and Incompetence. And I found that you still had to talk to people. People didn't necessarily come over and talk to you even when they read the sign. So I was just saying good morning and good afternoon to everybody, and eventually you pull them over and they say, you know, what's this? I tell them, and I said, you know, it's a free copy. And but the police never arrived, and I did have two solicitors turn up. One turned up, and she looked at the sign, and she looked at me, and she said, oh, what's this? And I told her, and she read the cover, and she started going through it, and she said, how much are these? And I said, oh, it's free. Do you know that was the biggest shock to her? She could actually understand that somebody could write a book about the corruption of the legal system, but she couldn't understand that I was giving it away free. And really, that's a good indicator of how a lawyer's mind works. So anyway, I said, take one. And it was very awkward for her, you know, not to have to pay for it. But she eventually took one. And then another solicitor came up, and she was asking me about it, and she was very furtive. She was sort of looking over her shoulder quite a lot. And she finally admitted that she was a solicitor. So I said, well, I'll take a copy. And she ran away. It was quite incredible. And after she ran away, I thought, oh, she's running off to tell somebody, and then the police will come round and somebody, but nobody ever did. And I gave away a lot of copies that day, so there's quite a few hundred circulating around the planet. But it does show up, but it was quite good. I was interested to talk to people. And again, once it was incredible, the number of people, once they realised what I was actually doing there and why I was giving away these books, the stories that started to pour out of these people's mouths about how they've been ripped off by lawyers and solicitors, how they lost hundreds of thousands of dollars. It was just mind-blowing. And some of them actually tried to do something about it, but unfortunately, you know, the system being what it is, they got nowhere. It was actually just costing them more to fight the system. So they just give up. And that's the way the system's being carefully manipulated and carefully controlled. And people do, they just give up. And, you know, they accept the loss of $50,000, $100,000, $200,000. They give up. And the apathy and the destruction of people's personalities and characters and their will to live is quite incredible. And that's the way the system works. That's what it does. It's designed that way. But you see, and this is why when I wrote the book, it was a complete shock to them, because, you see, when you think about it, I wrote one book. All I had to do was sit at the laptop and write one book. But computers are wonderful things, and printers are even better, because you can go to the little box and it says, how many copies would you like? And I just printed 700. And it just spews out books. So it's quite good. But I only wrote it once. And then you send it all around the country. And then if you send off 700 copies, 700 people are going to read it. And then 700 more people are going to read it, because they'll be passed on to somebody else. So, you know, I wrote one copy, but thousands and thousands and thousands of people have had to read it. And they have wasted thousands and thousands and thousands of hours doing it, just as they forced me to waste time writing it. By writing a book, you force them to waste time reading the damn thing. And so the spin-offs to writing a book is fantastic. This is why books are, the government and the World Organization are trying to shut down books, because books are very powerful things. And this is why publishing houses are breaking up. You know, all the small publishing houses that we used to have 30, 40, 50 years ago have all gone, because they've all been amalgamated. And then the big publishing houses that are left over, they have total control on the publication of books. So the number of good books that you get to read in the bookshop now, if there are any left in the high street, are zero. The only books that you'll get are cookery books and the Flight of the Condor book, or, you know, or How to Maintain Your Harley Motorcycle. But to get decent books describing the system and the world and what's going on, and good fictional books, good drama books and all the rest of it, they're all being shut down, because the publishing houses and the politics have total control of books now. This is why books like 50 Shades of Grey can sell millions of copies, and yet it's a pretty nothing book.
Mm. And yet Obama, the postmodern coup. What's that?
But we live in a funny world, and that's. But if you write a book, that's one of the beauties of writing a book, is you get people to read it, and they can actually hold it in their hands and hold your opinion and your thoughts in their hands and put it down, and the next day they can pick it up and read it again, that sort of thing. You see, we live in a world where if you turn on the television, they flick 10 scenes at you a second, and your eyes are just mesmerized by this flashing light on these scenes. You can't focus on anything. And all of television now is like that. And there's music banging away in the background all the time to obliterate your brain. And that's television. It's total brainwashing of the people. And if people were to throw away their television, society would change overnight. We'd all be, all people would start thinking again. We'd start talking to each other again. But television, unfortunately, controls their brains. It tells them what to think.
That reminds me of the speech in Network. All you people re-watch television, you eat like the tube, you drink like the tube, you dress your children like the tube.
Yep.
You're even starting to think like the tube.
That's exactly it. This is why, you know, if you turn on the television in New Zealand, if you get Sky Television or Television New Zealand or whatever, all you get are New Zealand trash, absolute trash. You get American trash. And you get a few good old-fashioned 1960s, 70s English comedy programs. You don't get anything from Italy. You don't get anything from France. You get anything from Germany, Spain, Sweden, Holland. All of these countries that all have their programs and interesting programs and drama programs and nature programs and science programs and all that bit. All of these countries produce them, and we don't get any of it. We are programmed to have New Zealand trash and American trash. And you would think that in a world where we have such great communication facilities, you know, with satellites and Sky Television, where we would actually have a solid gold 24-carat television program every single day, every single night. But we don't. We have 24-hour, 7-day-a-week trash. And it's been designed that way. That's what we do. This is why, you know, just to try and keep people watching television, they put old English drama programs and comedy programs on, just to give some people some relief somewhere in the day from the 24 hours of shit that they have to watch.
But tell us what you really think, Ian.
Well, what else do you want to know? What else do you want to know about writing or the Law Society or people?
I was wondering, where did you get the moral backbone to stand up against the scumbaggery filth?
It's just a sense of the difference between right and wrong in me. It's actually quite powerful. And it's taken me a great deal of my life to actually learn it and appreciate who I am in that area. Because I am, by and large, 99% pure pacifist. I will run away from a fight given half an opportunity. But what I found in my life is that sometimes the fight will come to you regardless. And then you use all sorts of other tactics and strategies to avoid that fight, and that's what I used to do. But again, the fight is often determined to come to you. So in the end, you get pushed to the edge of the cliff, and you have a choice. You either jump and you die, or else you turn around and you start fighting. And I learned in my life that my instinct is to turn around and I start fighting. And the interesting thing is that what I learned was that while in 1 second I was a pure pacifist and I wouldn't lift a fist to anybody, and you push me to the edge of the cliff and I turn around, I'll turn around and I'll use whatever means possible to destroy that entity that's trying to kill me. And the first time I did it, I was a surprise to myself about what I did. But it was an even greater surprise to myself that I succeeded comprehensively in what I was doing. And you learn a lot from that experience, and then it happened to me several times more. And when it came to fighting the Law Society here in Taranaki, I was actually quite experienced at understanding the psychology of bullies. And that's what it is. It's just ignorant bullies, and that's what the New Zealand Law Society is, and that's what the Taranaki District Law Society is. It's just a bunch of ignorant bullies. So it was quite easy once I learnt how to deal with these people, and once I'd established all the facts, you cannot talk to these people, they're too stupid. So then I wrote a book, and the conviction to write the book is simply the fact that what they're doing is wrong, and I simply will not stand by and watch other people being destroyed, have their lives, their families, their communities being destroyed by these pieces of shit, because they are just inhuman vacuums.
Freaking garbage, you know.
They are. They're total garbage. There are one or two good ones in there.
Well, I think it's like, I don't know, 99% of police officers make the other 1% look bad, you know? That kind of...
Well, in actual fact, one of the things that's quite curious with this country is that the police force in this country take an enormous amount of stick from the public, certain aspects, certain areas of the public, and the media when they decide to do something. But my experience of the New Zealand police is that New Zealand is blessed with, my belief, one of the best police forces on the planet.
Yeah, they're really, really hard to bribe. I've tried.
They are good people. There are the ones...
Well, some of them are, some of them aren't. It's kind of like 50-50, I'd say. Like about half my interactions with police have been really, really good, and about half of them they've been outright scumbags who just try to basically... start a fight with you for no reason, like even when you're asking them for help or something.
You're an Aucklander, aren't you?
Yeah,
it's different up in Auckland. By and large, I have found. I mean, I come from a background which is French and English and Scottish and Welsh, and I've travelled around the world and risked life and limb sometimes in some of the countries I've been ashore in when I've got off ships, you know, in South America and Panama and. Some of these places, you really have to be careful what you do. But no, I can honestly say that New Zealand has one of the best police forces on the planet. They are dedicated people. They deal with an enormous amount of crap. If there are any mountain rescue, air search, sea rescues and all that, you'll find the police there. They're incredibly skilled men. Many of them are, you know, they have enormous talents and great skills. And they understand the country that they live in. There are scumbags. I mean, I've met one or two, but they are, you'll get that in any society, in any walk of life, in any business. There's always one or two that are just pieces of crap, and they get tolerated. But by and large, the New Zealand police force is one of the best, I think, in the planet. Unfortunately, they have to deal with a law society that is one of the worst on the planet. And, I mean, there are some bad ones around the world. I mean, third world countries are notorious for having legal systems that are just pure corruption. But New Zealand has an awful one, with awful, awful people in it. As I say, there are one or two.
You've heard of fractal universe theory, right?
No, I haven't.
It's kind of like, you know, how a hologram works. You look into one part of the hologram, and what you see is the whole image of the whole hologram repeating itself, and then you look in further, and it keeps repeating itself over and over?
Yep.
Right. That's kind of like how the fractal universe theory is, you know, like you go from a cell to a human body to a planet to a galaxy to a red dwarf star cluster, so on and so forth, and it looks like the same repeating pattern. And so what I've discovered is that New Zealand is kind of like an example of fractal scumbaggery. For each instance of scumbaggery you look into, you start to see that all new whole entire universes of scumbaggery start to come to light.
Yeah, and it's something that's been very carefully cultivated over the last 30 years in this country. And the main contenders in this country for it are the political system, our so-called MPs, the legal system, and what's the third one? There was a third one I had in my mind. The corporations. These people totally control this country, which means that politically you can't fight it, legally you can't fight it. And the corporates are making all the money out of it, and this is the way it's been contrived. This is the way New Zealand has been made, and MMP is one of the most subtle pieces of corruption you could imagine. We have a government where half of our MPs shouldn't really be called MPs because they do not represent any constituency in New Zealand. They are elected purely on the basis of the party's vote for them. So you can actually have somebody placed into very high office in government in this country who has never, ever been elected or supported or voted for by any New Zealander. And this is the way MMP works. You've also got half the government who are paid to say whatever the party leader wants them to say.
Also, you have the vast amount of our prime ministers over the years all being educated overseas and working overseas, and then just come back here and just take the country over. They don't just sit in New Zealand, watch it get really bad, and then just go, you know what? I need to do something about this. No, they just sit overseas and they see that New Zealand hasn't gotten quite as messed up as where they're living at the moment, so they come back and you go, you know, I've got to help the country catch up, you know, it's my duty.
No, you just got to look at all the prime ministers we've had over the last 30 years. From David Longy was a disastrous little boy. He was a good speaker. He was quite eloquent. He would make these wonderful speeches. But he was actually a very naive little boy. The Rainbow Warrior thing really took him to task. I had just arrived in New Zealand, and a year later the Rainbow Warrior was sunk by the French. And David Longy was standing up, and he was saying all the right words. But then the French, to try and get their two saboteurs out of the country, started putting the squeeze on. And poor old David Longy, he just had no idea what he was dealing with. He's just coming out with all this rhetoric about he was going to lock all these Frenchmen away for 20 years, 30 years, and blah, blah, blah. And, of course, within a couple of years, they've been transferred to that island in the Pacific, and then a couple of years later, they're free. And that's the way the system works. He had just no idea what was going on in the world. And then after that, you have the likes of Jim Bolger and Jenny Shipley and Helen Clark, and now we've got John Key. And they're all sitting in American beds. They've all got American friends and American money. I mean, for goodness sake, John Key was playing golf with Barack Obama at Christmas.